That's all you need. Need all my notes.
you're just more precise than I am.
No, you're just more.
Right, are you all ready?
Listen, prepared.
Thank you. I hope you guys had a wonderful lunch. We now have the honor and privilege of hearing from two honored guests, actually. First, David Blankenhorn from the Institute for American Values and Dr. Linda Malone Colon from Hampton University. And to get you all acquainted with them, David Blankenhorn is both founder and president of the Institute for American Values, a nonpartisan organization devoted to studying and strengthening civil society. Blankenhorn is the founder of Fatherless America, The Future of Marriage, and Thrift, a cyclopedia, and is the co-editor of 8 edited volumes. A frequent lecturer, Blankenhorn's articles have appeared in scores of publications, including The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times, USA Today, First Things, and Christianity Today. He has been profiled by The New York Times, USA Today, CBS Evening News, and other news organizations, and has been featured on numerous national television programs, including The Legend That Is Oprah, CBS This Morning, The Today Show, Charlie Rose, ABC Evening News, and C-SPAN's Washington's Perspective. In 1977, he graduated magna cum laude in social studies from Harvard, where he was president of Phillips Brook House, the Campus Community Service Center, and the recipient of a John Knox Fellowship. In 1978, he was awarded an MA with distinction in comparative social history from the University of Warwick in Coventry, England. But he now chooses to currently reside in New York City. I take it that you enjoy it there? Very much so? Good. I'm an urban lover, so I... future plans. Now on to Dr. Linda Malone Colon. She is currently the chair of the psychology department at Hampton University, a senior fellow at the Institute for American Values, and the former executive director of the National Healthy Marriage Resource Center. She is also the founder and executive director of the new National Center for African American Marriages and Parenting at Hampton University. Dr. Malone Colon is a noted scholar, national speaker, and consultant on African American marriages. She has worked with several healthy marriage research projects, including serving as a research specialist for the African American Healthy Marriage Initiative, participating in the Building Strong Families Research Project Technical Work Group, acting on the DC Healthy Marriage Coalition Executive Committee, and assisting with the Anne E. Casey Foundation initiative designed to strengthen marriages in low-income communities inside the United States. Finally, she has designed and teaches a premier course on Black marriages for college students that has been featured in the annual Smart Marriages Conferences and in Essence Magazine. Dr. Malone Colon earned a PhD in personality psychology with a minor in neuropsychology and a MS degree in clinical psychology at Howard University. And with that, we'd like to turn it over to y'all.
Thank you so much, Rebecca, and thank everyone who has had some role in holding this conference, for making this happen. Thank you for being here. Of course, we feel that this is a very important topic for us to address. I'm so honored to be here presenting with my friend and colleague, David Blankenhorn. Actually, he has become my brother over the years, and we're very fond of each other and have done a lot of things together. So this is what we will be doing today. We'll begin by defining what father involvement is, what we mean when we're talking about father involvement, just to sort of make sure that we're all on the same page, okay? And we're just going to do that by identifying some essential dimensions of father involvement. Then we'll discuss very briefly how marriage itself and and interparental relationships, whether parents are married or not, impacts father involvement, okay? And next, we're going to focus on the unique contributions of father involvement to children's psychological and emotional and relational adjustment and development, okay? And we're going to look more specifically at how girls are affected and how boys are affected, okay? And also, while I'm speaking, I'll be making some special references to what's happening in the African American community, okay? And that's because the conditions are worse here in this community. And what we've seen is that as the African American community goes, so goes the rest of the country. So there are so many insights that we can get from looking at what's happening in the African-American community when we start to look for solutions, as we start to look for solutions, okay? And finally, we'll look at some ways that fathers and mothers parent differently. There's some different parenting styles for fathers and mothers. And we'll look at how marriage particularly impacts father involvement, okay? And then most importantly, we want to hear from you, okay? We want to hear your wisdom. We want your questions. So we want to have a real good discussion here and time to hear from you. Okay, so first, the dimensions of father involvement that have been identified or usually identified in the research are things like providing, supporting the mother, disciplining and teaching responsibility, encouraging success in school, giving praise and affection, spending time together and talking, being attentive to child's needs, reading to children, and encouraging children to develop their talents. Okay? So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about father involvement. We're talking about these things. Okay? Now, as we discuss father involvement, it's important to keep in mind that the research shows again and again that marriage itself and interparental relationships, whether those parents are married or not, affects father involvement. So if fathers are married to the children, to the wives of their children, then they're more likely to be involved in their children's lives. That's so as we talk about this, we want to be clear about that. That if fathers are married to the wives of their children, No wonder you're grinning. Okay. If fathers are married to their children's mother, okay, does that work? Then they're much more likely to be involved in their children's lives. And also, whether they're married or not, if they have a good relationship, they're more likely to be involved. Okay. So the better the relationship between parents, the more involved fathers are, the more likely they are to be involved in children's lives. So here are just a few examples. One study showed that fathers said that they were more involved when the interparental relationships had less conflict and were more cooperative. Okay? And another, fathers who reported greater marital intimacy were more involved in caregiving. In another, there were higher levels of marital satisfaction, and mothers' perception of their husband's competence was associated with higher levels of father involvement. And it goes on and on. There are so many studies that show that the relationship between mom and dad affect father involvement. If we look at the unique contributions of father's involvement to the child's psychological and emotional and relational adjustment and development, there's a lot of research here, too, that shows that children do better psychologically. They're less likely to be depressed. They're less likely to act out in school. They're less likely to be delinquent. They're less likely to use drugs and to drink. They do better academically. So in so many areas of psychological and emotional and relational development, the research shows pretty consistently that when fathers are involved in children's lives, they do better, okay? But we want to unpack this a bit for how father involvement affects girls and how it affects boys, okay? First of all, when girls do not have fathers who are involved, they have a greater chance of being socialized to be independent of men, to function independent of men, to not know the provisions and the protections of a man, to not know the caring and the adoration of a man. Chances are they will hear and be more receptive to hearing and internalizing the, you ever heard this? I don't need a man. Okay? The I don't need a man message that sometimes comes even from their mothers. When in reality, we do need men, don't we? And men need women. It's really in our DNA. We need each other. So one unique contribution that fathers make to their daughters is to help them to not be in denial about, to acknowledge their real need for relationship with men. And this acknowledgement helps to increase the likelihood that someday they will be in a loving and lasting relationship. First one. Conversely, father absence may be associated with some girls becoming excessively dependent and needy, continually seeking the attention, love, and support that they needed from their fathers, from other men who, like their fathers, are not available emotionally. Okay? Some clinicians have identified something that's called the fatherless woman syndrome, where there's a fear of rejection and abandonment and commitment. There's a feeling of being unworthy, unlovable. There's depression. There's overdoing in terms of the superwoman syndrome, or overdrinking, or drugging, or overeating. Okay? So, as one of my students noted in class, when fathers are involved in their daughters' lives, they're more likely to know their worth, okay? And they're more likely to have self-respect. Also, father involvement in the form of father love, acceptance, and adoration for daughters goes a long way in helping to facilitate self-awareness, self-acceptance, and self-love in little girls, okay? Because we live in a society where there's so many messages that can lower the self-esteem of little girls and women. So having daddy's love and ability to see the princess in his little girl can help to really protect her from these negative influences. For example, Black women have historically, and until today, are bombarded with societal demands and messages that don't affirm their femininity and physical beauty. And this is part of the pride and joy of any woman, okay? The myth of the strong Black woman who was tough, hard, not vulnerable is a burden for a lot of Black women. So having a father there to protect and take care of her early on helps her to know the role that a man can play in protecting and affirming her soft and weak places, okay? And the portrayals of what defines physical beauty through the media that portray dark skin, kinky hair, broad noses, big hips, big lips as unattractive physically have caused many body image problems for many Black women. Having a father there early on to affirm her physical beauty can help to prevent these untruths from getting into her consciousness and settling there. Also, father involvement helps to protect girls from a pervasive and generalized distrust of men in our society that comes with many stereotypical messages and images about male irresponsibility, male sexual and emotional weakness, and inhumanity. This in turn helps girls to be less trusting, less able to be vulnerable and open with men. When their dads aren't there, their absence is in fact affirming, making real these negative messages about men that girls are getting. These girls have a greater chance of putting up impenetrable emotional walls that prevent them from attracting loving and responsible men and developing intimate relationships with them. For example, there are lots of stereotypical messages out there about Black men as irresponsible, lacking integrity, uncaring, criminals, aggressive, sexually not to be trusted. Yet some of the most humane human beings, that I have known in my life have been black men, starting with my father and my grandfather, and although this isn't someone that I had a paternal relationship with, my deceased fiance. These three men are some of the most honest, caring, generous, responsible, and family-oriented human beings that I've ever known. So no one can convince me that black men are this way, because I have real-life experiences with an example of men who were the antithesis of this because of my own father's involvement and my grandfather's involvement. Okay? Further, father involvement also helps to protect girls from men who might mistreat them and abuse them. When dad is there to check out these men who are checking out his daughter, these men are likely to be a bit more circumspect in how they treat daddy's little girl, to stay a bit more in check because they know they have another man that they are accountable to answer to if they mess up, right? Okay. Related to this, when fathers are involved in their daughters' lives, they help to prevent them from feelings of desperation to have a man at any cost, to settle, okay, to be treated anyway. And then there's the hope that involved dads help to ignite in their daughters. Having dad there helps to foster hope in girls that they can one day have a dad there for their children and a loving partner in their life. With increasing and so many examples of absent dads, girls are less likely to be hopeful that they can one day attain their heart's desire to be in a healthy marriage and to have the father of their children be a responsible father. It's human for us to resist seeking after and dreaming about that which we don't think is attainable, okay? The pain of a dream deferred may be thought to be greater than the denial or the absence of the dream in the first place. Having an involved father encourages girls to dream and gives girls hope, okay? So we want to look at boys now. There are many special ways that boys benefit psychologically, emotionally, and relationally from having their fathers involved in their lives. And one of the biggest is the benefit of having a role model, a model of manhood, a model of fatherhood, and a model of how to be in relationship with women. Boys with involved fathers have a greater chance of learning firsthand and in a consistent and day-to-day way what true manhood is, what it means to be a man, really, and that personal responsibility and responsibility for one's family are essential parts of manhood. They're more likely to benefit from having the guidance that boys need to become men and to be given the roadmap of how to get there by observing manhood in their fathers and hearing their father's journey to manhood. These boys are less likely to receive their primary socialization, their foundational principles and values for life from influencers and influences outside the home, and to learn their definitions of manhood from their peers, who often, too, may lack male or fatherly models and guidance. For example, Charles Johnson, who heads up a rites of passage program for boys in Los Angeles, has observed that many black males are learning through media messages and the street that to be a man, you must be violent, have lots of money, be sexually active, and that is have a lot of women, and go to jail. Having a father involved in their lives helps to protect them from internalizing these distorted and destructive views of manhood. When dads are not involved, some sons are more likely to lack models of fatherhood, of how to father, co-parent, and in the case of married fathers, how to be a spouse. So these boys may not benefit from having a role model and a roadmap for how to be a father to their children and how to be in relationship with their children's mother in a way that benefits their children. How to relate to women in their lives in respectful ways. Boys with involved fathers are more likely to learn something that's real important, commitment, what it looks like and what it behaves like, and the significance of being there for others, particularly one's children, an important lesson to learn for future family relationships. When fathers are involved, boys are so much less likely to be violent and aggressive. This is in part because when fathers are absent, just like girls, the boys feel abandoned, and they're more likely to feel unworthy and angry. And boys are more likely to externalize their feelings through aggression, violence, acting out. Okay? And then there's another piece. Mothers of sons whose fathers are absent may be more likely to feel anger toward those fathers and to feel resentment against these fathers, who they may feel have emotionally wounded them because of their absence in their sons' lives, and maybe too in their own lives, and to see their son's father in their sons. These mothers may be more likely to look at these sons and see in them the person who caused them tremendous pain and hurt, the person that they feel the most resentment and anger toward, and to therefore displace that anger and negative judgments and perceptions of the father onto the son. So when fathers are involved in their sons' lives, these sons also benefit more from their mother's expressed acceptance and adoration. Finally, I want to point out, note a few ways that black children are socialized and parented that may be associated with some unique advantages of fatherhood or father involvement for black children. Research has shown that black parents make fewer distinctions than other groups of parents in raising their children, though they do make some distinctions. And one of the distinctions that they make is that black parents tend to, this is what the research has shown, tend to support competence and self-reliance more in girls than in boys. And black mothers especially are less likely to discipline their sons than their daughters, or to teach them independence and responsibility. So when dad is not there, learning personal responsibility and self-sufficiency becomes even more of a problem for black boys. And I say this also saying that this is understandable that this is happening. There are some harsh realities that black parents need to protect their sons from. There are societal forces that put black boys and men more at risk. They're more likely to be victims of crime, perpetrators of crime. They're more likely to be incarcerated. They're less likely to be highly educated and to be gainfully employed. Also, there are some socializing agents outside the home that influence gender roles for black boys, particularly as they grow older and more into adolescence and adulthood. They especially may be influenced to value the more traditional gender roles of the dominant society. So even though black relationships have been found to be more egalitarian, a sociologist by the name of Elaine Penderhuis found that African-American men highly value the traditional sex role power distribution and male authority more than African-American women, more than white men, more than white women. She notes that this may be a reaction to threats to their masculinity by the broader society, and I would add to the lack of fathers who are there to affirm their masculinity in the face of these threats. Black men have historically had limited access to power in the larger society and fewer opportunities to fulfill the traditional masculine role of provider, protector within their families. All the more reason to have a father there who can help them to negotiate these challenges. sociologist, black sociologist by the name of C.W. Franklin, notes that black males and females are socialized into gender roles that may not complement one another, that males are socialized to assume certain aspects of traditional masculinity and not others, to be aggressive and dominant physically and sexually in relationships with women, and indifferent with regard to the provider role and the work ethic. That females are socialized to be aggressive and dominant, consistent with high masculinity, and to assume nurturing, warm, and expressive roles, consistent with high femininity. So black women are socialized to be more androgynous. And there's some evidence that black men are feeling threatened by and even resentful of the assertiveness, strength, and accomplishments of black women in their lives. Okay? Some black women, on the other hand, are feeling very angry and resentful and worn out because they feel like they have to do it all. What better way to get us beyond all of this, to get us out of this vicious cycle, than to get fathers involved in their children's lives? Okay? So these are just some things to think about. I hope that we will talk some more, we'll hear from you some more about the ways that you think the father involvement uniquely affects girls and uniquely affects boys in this way. And now you're going to hear from my brilliant friend, David Blankenhorn, who's going to provide his wisdom, okay, on how mothers and fathers parent differently and how marriage uniquely impacts fathers' involvement. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you, Linda. That was really great. Thank you. Thank you all for being here today. Linda talked a little bit about the father-child relationship from the child's point of view, the emotional, psychological development of the child. I want to talk about the subject a little bit from the man's point of view, or the father's point of view. And I want to begin by talking about the father as the first other in a child's life, the first person that is distinguishable as sort of separate from me and my mother. So that, for example, if you were to walk up to somebody and I was just to toss a baby at you, the likelihood is that you would catch the baby and hold it closer to like this. Whereas if I were to toss the baby to you, the likelihood is that you would catch it, hopefully, but you would hold it like this, like you were holding a pizza, and sort of want to, you know, see if he'll grab your finger. So there's a distance, right? There's more. The mother goes this way, soothing, comfort, nurture. The father is going to, like, oh, make eye contact, see if, you know, maybe throw him up in the air a little bit. You know, there's more. So there's a immediately, the father is this intimate stranger, a first other, the first person in the child's life that's different from that sort of sacred bond or that magic bond of the mother and the infant. So a couple of years later, the child's on the playground, climbing the jungle gym. You know, it varies, but generally speaking, the way a mother would love that child and nurture that child would be to say something like, you know, be careful, don't hurt yourself, you know, are you dressed warmly, you know. Father more may say those things, but would also, like, God, see if you can climb all the way to the top, you know, like, go further out. So the studies show, for example, that if a father is present in the lives of his child, that child is less afraid of strangers, less fearful of sort of venturing out into the world, because this the mother, this source of sort of 24/7 unconditional love, support, nurture, is balanced by this somewhat little more distant, but also intimate person who's stressing pushing the boundaries a little bit, going further out, maybe a little bit more tolerant of risk-taking, okay? So, you know, they do these studies fathers are, the love is a little more contingent often. It's a little bit more like the mother says, I love you. The father says some version of, I love you, and I want you to follow certain rules, meet certain, you know, like, I want you to follow certain rules. There's a contingent quality to it, right? To some degree, I love you if. There's a little bit of that in there, you know, wanting you to, a little more rule-oriented. Fathers tend to be people who are a little more emphasis somewhat on rule setting. Mothers more on like, yes, rules, but also in the context of relationship and that sort of ongoing intimacy. So I don't want to overdo this. And there are obviously mothers who are, you know, these are generalizations and they're individuals who vary and it varies out of culture and, you know, sex role establishment and so on. So one doesn't want to go too far with this, but the cross-cultural studies do show that father love and mother love are overlap but also have somewhat distinctive qualities that men tend to bring a particular set of inclinations and aptitudes to the parental vocation that are not the same as the mothers. They overlap, but they're distinctive. And what's really great about it is that some people have said, well, the default, you know, the perfect parent is the maternal model. And others have said, no, the right model is this paternal model that has a little more distance, I'm calling the distance factor or the other, the father as the other. But Eric Erickson and a whole range of wonderful researchers and thinkers have really emphasized that they work together in this wonderful, almost magic way, so that the father cannot give his child all that the child needs. The mother cannot give her child all that the child needs. But the mother and father together, the mother love in complementarity with the father love, we hope can give the child what the child needs. So it's not just climb to the top of the playground, and it's not just be safe. It's both, and the mother and father together. Okay, that's the best research we have shows that it's this... almost a kind of, there's a mystery and magic to it. It when it works together to give the child the whole parent, you know, it's like there's no such thing as a parent, really. There's parenting that needs the mothering and the fathering together in a kind of a intricate dance. It's beautiful. Okay, so... you know, some of this is culturally determined. There are sex roles, you know, the sociology, there are sex roles and there are cultural norms, blah, blah. But, you know, and that's all true. Also, some of it is biological and chemical, you know? So let's talk a little bit quickly about both of them, and let's talk a little bit about the biological and sort of the biochemistry of fatherhood. Have you ever noticed that we humans are incredibly sexual animals? Has this really dawned? I think this must have dawned on me at a certain point. And, you know, now most primates are not that way. You know, Most primates spend their lives, the males and females have very little to do with one another. They come together during very defined periods, during periods of female estrus. Copulation is a fairly intense but also perfunctory and short-lived activity. There's not a lot of ritual to it, and then they go about their merry lives. Most primate males do not even recognize their own children, do not provide food for their own children, and so on and so on. Parenting is a female task. The fathers inseminate and go off to do whatever the heck they're doing. Humans are different. Why? Because in the course of our evolutionary adaptedness, we became very sexy animals. We're interested in sex all the time. You know, your average ape or whatever, you know, they just, during periods of, there's a period of female estrus. In humans, the estrus has been leveled out over time. Women are fertile all the time, 24/7. So it's come up and see me anytime, not just during this one little period. Most primates, the sexual switch is off most of the time and on some of the time. For humans, it's on all the time. So we're this and we have evolved physically. Our eyes get bigger when we become sexually aroused, as every cartoonist in the country knows. Enlarged female breasts, physical evolution so that sexual intercourse occurs face to face, or can't often occurs face to, you know, we are highly attuned sexual creatures, giving and emitting sexual signals all the time. Very different, very distinctive. Why? Why would it be? Why would this have happened to us humans? Well, is it because God wants to make sure we had babies? You know? Not really. You can make babies the other way. You don't need any of this to make babies. It's to make the couple. It's to bond the couple. I'm saying this in simple language, but the scholars have really looked at this pretty carefully. Human sexuality evolved in order to bond the male and the female together into an enduring relationship, into a sexual bond that was also a social and parental and legal bond. Why? Why do we want this to happen? Want it biologically? Why are our chemicals and bodies sort of orient us in this direction? Because, and again, there are alternative theories, but the best and most convincing scholarship on this tells you, because we humans figured out that the human mother needs a mate, and that the human child needs a father. And we want to bring the male into the magic circle. We want to bring the male into the magic bond. And unlike other primates who do not do this, we have guys holding babies. And that's the secret. That's the way that it works with us so the sex bond is not in the interest of a wild and crazy sex life. It is not in the interest of procreation in any physical sense. It is in the interest of creating the couple, the pair-bonded couple. Why? Because we humans have evolved in a way such that we have come to believe and live out the fact that the parental task should involve both the mother and the father. We want to admit the father to the magic circle. Well, this gets reinforced also, of course, by society. It's not just, I also meant to say, when I say chemicals, I don't know, did Dr. Rhodes, and we must have talked about oxytocin and okay, I won't go into all that. But did he tell you that when sexual intercourse releases oxytocin into the body of a female, and it's oxytocin not only makes you more likely to feel a feeling of love toward your sex partner, but it also is the very same thing that bonds you to a baby and releases milk. And, you know, so in males, the sexual bond causes testosterone to drop. So you become a little bit of a softer guy, less interested in tomcatting around all the time and not wanting to fight so much. Your testosterone drops. And so there's this, you know, sometimes people in love or in love with a new baby, they'll say, this feels like a drug. I feel addicted. You are being addicted. It is. There are these chemicals that are, you know, it's kind of this amazing thing. So okay. But there's also social roles that are encouraging and complementing the same procedure. In 1948, the anthropologist Margaret Mead said, quote, "The supreme task of any society is to teach its men to be good fathers." So why would she have said that? Why would she be singling out fathers and feminist anthropologist, what's going on? Mead was acknowledging in that, I believe, very true statement that when it comes to parenting, men are the weaker sex. Men, if society stops caring what happens to children, mothers will still, generally speaking, be there. It's the males who will drift away when society stops caring. Men have a natural capacity and desire to love their children, but it is not the same as the mother-child bond. The men will drift unless society has a story, something that it's teaching them, a story that involves heroism, sacrifice, an understanding, as Linda said, of what true masculinity is all about. So that's what Margaret Mead said. It was the weaker sex needs the bolstering of a cultural narrative and story in order to enter into the magic circle and to stay there as a reliable partner to the mother and the good father to the child. Now, the tragedy of our generation, my generation, maybe you people can fix this, is that we've stopped. Not only do we fail the test of saying that the supreme test is whether you can be a good father, we don't even think of it as a test anymore, right? As a society, we've kind of turned our eyes away from even confronting that question in any kind of serious way. So that's why we have so many children without fathers in their lives. But when Margaret Mead said this, she was talking about a cultural story, a cultural narrative, a set of cultural norms that reinforce and complement and give orientation to the biochemistry of human pair bonding. Now, there's a funny word that we use to describe all this in everyday language, and that word is marriage. That's it. That's the word we use. So I want to take you back 4,000 years, very briefly, to a guy named Lipit Ishtar, who ruled over the kingdoms of Sumer and Akkad in ancient Mesopotamia in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley in what is now Iraq. And an interesting thing happened 4,000 years ago in this kingdom. This guy made up the first marriage laws that we know about, the first recorded laws, or certainly among the first, the oldest laws of marriage that the human record reveals. And he said in his famous laws, after saying that he was the great Lipit Ishtar who was favored by the gods, the first law we have says, with a decree, I made the father stand by his children. I made the children stand by their fathers. That was the law. And then he went on to specify what it meant that that would happen. What was the what were the terms in which a mother and father would be married to one another? But what I'm really trying to drive at is, if we look at the fundamental purpose of marriage in human groups, going back to the first time anyone said anything about it, there are many purposes of marriage, but probably the most important one, the most important single purpose, is to make sure, insofar as society can make sure, that the male and the female whose sexual bond brings a child into this world will be there not only as genitors, not only as biological parents, but will be there as social and legal parents in a parental partnership. And the word we use is marriage, and that's the game. So, and I guess what I'm trying to say about the father's role, in this, I'm going to just wrap this up now. You heard Linda talk about this very special role that the father can play in the psychological and emotional development of his sons and his daughters. I've tried to talk a little bit about this from the male's point of view, that is, how it kind of feels in terms of the male role and its relationship to marriage. But what I think, if I had to say one thing in closing, it would be that there's a sense that the male is kind of auditioning in all this. The male is the weaker partner here. It sort of goes back to courtship. In the traditional courtship concept, the male is auditioning, right? If I want to court you, I'm going to come forward. I'm going to say, hey, look at what I have. You know, I've got this, I've got that, I'm a pretty good guy. And your job is to go, well, let's see, maybe, yeah, okay, I like that. Yes, okay, fine. And I'm going to go, boom, you know, I bow. It's right, I'm auditioning. I want the favor, right? I want the good stuff. I'm asking you, right? And you're saying, oh, well, let's see, you know, maybe, call me later, you know. That's the way it goes. It goes that way. That is replicated in the parent, in their parenthood relationship. The father can almost never keep the mother away. I mean, the mother and the child are this basic unit. The father has to be let in. He has to audition. He has to kind of prove his worth. If the mother doesn't want the father involved, the father's not very likely to be involved. The two preconditions for effective fatherhood across cultures are, one, co-residency with the child, and two, a good partnership with the mother. Now, there may be supermen out there who can do fatherhood, who can be fathers without living with their children and with not getting along with the mother, but it's extremely rare. For average guys, you got to live with the child, and you have to have the acceptance of the mother, the partnership of the mother. It doesn't work the other way around nearly as much. It's the guy who's, you know, I asked an anthropologist one time, a great guy, I said, why is it that the old men in the tribes always lead the prayers? It's very rarely the old women. It's always the old men. He said, well, I don't know. That's a good question. He said, I think it's because everybody knows that the women already have God in them. It's the women are participating with God in creation in a way that men are not. That was his opinion. So it's this kind of this auditioning thing. That's why what you're talking about today is so important, not only in terms of the courtship that Brad talked about in Danielle, but also this very beleaguered institution of marriage, very under threat, very misunderstood. It is our most pro-child social institution precisely because it is the one institution that will allow both the male and the female to bring their aptitudes and inclination and ability to invest in their children. It is the one and only institution that does that amazing thing. And you all, you know, on my clock, we've made a mess of it. I've made a big league mess of it. So I hope you all will be strong and countercultural and not too deferential in terms of following the established customs. Don't do it. Just try to figure out a better way to have this parent-giving institution make it through your little time that you have to make a difference. Thanks.
All right, we're going to open it up for questions.
And can I say this, too? We want to hear your wisdom. You know, not just questions, but we want to hear what you think about what we had to say, okay? Or if you have something to add to what we had to say, in addition to questions. Does that work? Okay. Yes.
I'm going to have to put on flat soon.
Thank you both so much for a wonderful presentation. The notion that men and women bring unique but complementary gifts to parenting, and that neither in isolation can provide a child with all that it needs, would seem to have serious implications not only on the no-fault divorce culture, but on more recent cultural phenomenon like gay marriage and gay adoption in particular. And I wondered if you might discuss some of those implications and also discuss whether the social scientific data has caught up with everything that you know, that these insights.
Well, it does have, you know, if you say with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, if you say that the child has a birthright to know her mother and her father, if you take that seriously, it does have important implications for all these policy issues you're talking about. I think that people who believe the way I believe, and probably I don't want to speak for Brad or Linda or any, I mean, but it just, if I could just say we, or I mean, you know, some, I mean, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, you can say Brad, but I think our side is losing badly right now on almost every possible front. I thought maybe we made some progress in the 90s with the shifting of scholarly opinion toward recognition of the importance of the two-parent home and so on. And I thought that there were, you know, there were some things that happened that were positive. But I think in generally now it's a very, it's a time when the virtue, if it's a virtue, I really don't think it is, but the quality of optimism is not very relevant. And you have to go to the virtue of hope in order to, you know what I mean? It's not a, so have these insights caught up with policy and culture? No, I don't think so. Yeah.
And for those of us who are very passionate about this and really see the connections as scientists between marriage and the relationship between mom and dad and child well-being and the well-being of our country, actually, who really see this connection. All the evidence is there empirically and have really been involved in doing everything that we can from wherever we can to turn this thing around. One of the ways that we often get challenged is on things like that. I know when it has never failed that if I'm speaking on radio or TV or to a journalist somewhere, they will ask me that question. So what do you think about same-sex marriage? Okay? And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact specifically that 72% of black children are born out of wedlock and what impact this is having on our children and our communities and our country. You know, I'm talking about the fact that the marriage rate.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm talking. Yeah, so I'm talking about what can. Yeah, what can we do to strengthen this foundational institution that has everything to do with everything in our lives? Okay, and so that's one of the major challenges that we face. Just what you're talking about.
I know that I've had African-American friends before that have come from good families and had good fathers and everything, that they've shared with me that they've faced ridicule from their fellow African-American people that they encounter sometimes about this. Like, you know, it's almost like they're seen in a negative light for coming from, you know, an upstanding area. It's like, or for taking on responsibility in a correct manner. And I think that kind of goes with the masculinity thing. It's seen almost as unmasculine. You said you need a father there to provide a good example of masculinity. But how hard is that for those people then to have their peers oftentimes criticizing them for acting that way?
It's very hard. And it's part of the battle that, you know, we're dealing with. Because even for those kids, we're being raised in, and I don't want to define one family as good and one as bad, but being raised with their dads and their moms really involved in their lives and married to one another and doing all everything that they can for their children, then they go out there in society and have people who are putting them down when they are striving to really be successful in life, when they haven't, quote, come from the ghetto or places where they're not getting the support that they need. And, but it's a shame in many ways that black kids are being discouraged from being, quote, successful, you know, in some ways. And so, you know, what I say, you know, to my students and when I speak to young people and all the young people that I know is that you have to fight this, because this is not, you know, you have bought into some myth about who you are. This isn't who you are, you know, so it's in part helping to, you know, and for those, it's for us, you know, the elders, you know, speaking up and saying, this isn't who you are, you know, and really speaking to who they really are and speaking to their the power that they do have and the greatness that they do have and the potential that they do have within them. And I think that's in part what, you know, we try to, this is one of the things we try to do through what we're doing, you know. To speak to that. Very good point. Thank you.
That's a lot louder than I thought. Okay. I had a belief, like, just kind of things that I've picked up. Like, I think music has a lot to do with it. I think, like, as music changes, that society changes. I don't think that, like, the society influences the music as much as the music influences the society. And I think that the beats create like lots of lust, like when you have hard beats and then even like the lyrics, they get progressively worse each generation. And I think that, like, you know, from the 50s, like Rock On, that kind of you'd see the collapse of the family. And on Optimism, like at our campus, we had Anscombe Society. It's kind of the equivalent of Off the Hook. And we kind of tried to stand against the powers that be. Like, they had a sex conference at the school, Sex Blow or something. And we stood and we handed out flowers and information on chastity. And they called the police the first day when the police didn't shut us down because they couldn't. The police just said, don't stand in the way. and they called housing, and housing couldn't shut us down. And then, like, they tried to call housing again, and finally they sent us an email saying, you guys can't come back. But by this time, like, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette had already come and was going to take pictures, and the student newspaper got involved, and, like, everyone got involved. Even people who didn't like us said, we have to respect their courage. And, like, I don't know. I think optimism for me is more like you... Like, I have no intention of reaching everybody, but I have an intention of making a strong platform and safe space that an individual can go and feel like, you know, there are people who are like me. I'm not abnormal. Society is abnormal. So I guess that's kind of more of my view, because I was just... Because, like, okay, because your view, because maybe, like, when you were younger, marriage was more of, like, a respected institution. Like, I grew up with that it wasn't. So I guess our sense of optimism is just different.
Yeah.
So powerful. Thanks for that. One of the things that I think is that we can not do this work unless we have optimism, unless we have hope. Okay? Because it's just so big, and we're fighting this uphill battle, you know? So it's really good.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I listened to what you said, and I kind of switched the scenario, and I thought of arranged marriages. And arranged marriages are usually two people brought together, and then they form family. And usually their family is very successful, and they tend to stay together. And this isn't only in Middle Eastern societies or Eastern societies. This is also, there are, you know, even churches here who, like Unification Church, who have arranged marriages to this day. I wanted to ask, based on your talk and the information you presented, why do families of arranged marriages survive? And what is the quality that people of non-arranged marriages lack that these arranged families have?
Well, the arranging is done by the extended families, and I think the strength of those marriages is that it occurs within a very thick family and social ecology that is supportive of the marriage. I mean, if you study societies where this goes on, you know, it really is the marriage is centers around the couple, but it really involves two family groups coming together with extensive, gift exchanges, all kinds of interweaving, and so and it provides a very strong set of rules and roles and expectations for the marital couple in relationship with a wide extended family network. And I would say that's the source of stability of these marriages. What they lack sometimes, what we have privileged in our own society is a much more individualistic conception of the two lovers finding themselves increasingly on their own, absent any of the above, really, or except in much attenuated ways. I don't think that, well, I'm not going to make any big analysis about what's better or what's worse, but I think the answer to your question is, it's in the arranged marriages occur in a social context where there is a very thick, strong, two extended families coming together. And that's really, and you still see this in parts of our own country. I mean, you can see places where this is still going on a little bit, and you can really tell the difference. So
I wonder too if it might have something to do with the intentions of the people who are getting into those marriages. I mean, I don't know, this is something I don't know anything about at all, but if the intention is to get married for the purpose of, in part, a big part of having children and staying in this relationship, raising a family for the long term, rather than an intention that's more based on what can I get individually out of this relationship. You know, and sometimes that's the whole soulmate model. You know, what do I, I've got to find my soulmate. And yeah.
It's not really based on a sexual attraction model either. Yeah. It's completely alien to the way we do courtship here.
I have one more question relating to it. So in kids in who are in families or have parents that were in arranged marriage, what turns out, like, how do they, you know, turn out in the long run based on what you were saying, since they do have the fatherly figure that you were talking about, and the motherly figure, what are they missing, as they grow up, since they have the two?
It's just such a different cultural world. I mean, it's like, you know, you. I don't really feel qualified to answer the question, except to say that insofar as I've looked at this, it really is just, it's not just that one thing of the arranged marriage. It's an entirely different way of thinking about society. And I suppose what they lack is the sphere of individual expressiveness and freedom and experimentation that we so highly prize in our culture. And what they gain is a much more stable social structure. You got to, yep.
Hi. My question is, how do you think, or how have you seen that the message of a faithful marriage between a man and a woman can sort of be portrayed or communicated to the society on a whole versus just like in certain subgroups of society? So obviously here it's a very, you know, conservative, perhaps even like a religious group that is here to listen to the message, and it's very receptive. But going out into the world in our campuses or even in our workplaces, it can be very difficult to portray this message and have it be heard. So what do you think are the best means that we can do that?
Okay. One of the things I think is to be very careful in how we talk about this, that we are, when we talk about the significance of marriage and father involvement, that we're still affirming single parents and single mothers and single dads and and that we're acknowledging that these can be, you know, these are good families too. These are families too. And so it's also how we think about it, because if we are perceiving those families in a negative light, then that's going to come across. So it's being very sensitive to still the strengths in those families, although we hold up this ideal and we know that this is something that they want as well. I think being careful about who the messengers are, that we have a diverse group of messengers, that we have single parents who are messengers, we have married parents who are messengers, we have people who've divorced who are messengers, you know. I think those are some of the things that come to mind for me. You have some ideas, David?
Well, that's one reason why I came here. I figured I'd look around and see if there was any good ideas coming from you all about that. Seriously, I mean, really. I think what Linda said is really important. One of my favorite lines from Solzhenitsyn is that the line separating good and evil does not run between you and me, but through the center of every human heart. And we have to really keep that in mind as we talk to people about this subject. I guess the only thing I might add is that people of faith are called upon to be bilingual in our society. In other words, we're in the secular public discourse that privileges reason giving and things like what the studies show and so forth. You have to really, I find, learn to speak in that way. I'm not Catholic, but I find the Catholic natural law tradition helpful because that's a tradition where you learn to make public arguments in a way that doesn't presuppose agreement on fundamental questions of faith. And I grew up in the South in the evangelical world, and I love these people and admire them in so many ways, but I think that evangelicals have a very hard time doing this. They think they're hiding their light under a bushel. They think that unless it's come to Jesus, then they're not saying the right thing. And so for people of faith, the challenge is, I think, to figure out how to, I guess, just how to be bilingual. I think that's the simplest way I've heard it said, and in wrestling with how to do that. And, I really do mean that one of the reasons I accepted this wonderful invitation to be here was I wanted to see how you all talked about it. I mean, I'm kind of interested in that question of how one talks about this thing. And I know that the sponsoring, the people that pulled this conference together are wrestling with that themselves in their own work and having some success with it. So that's good.
I guess just a comment. Something that's always brought me hope is I really believe the reality that it's very hard to unhear the truth, that even if you reject it, like if there's something true about that, something you just heard, that it'll stay with people. And the beauty and integrity of a good marriage, I think, is something that everybody really wants. And we've just been given in our generation a completely awful script to try and get at it. But approaching people from the perspective that, like, everybody wants to be happy. Like, that's what we want. And we're just sort of disagreeing about how we go about becoming happy rather than turning other people into the enemy or arguing about things that we disagree on, but kind of remembering that we all want to be happy and kind of basing that as a common ground, I think, is important.
As you were speaking, I was thinking that I have certainly done more than my fair share of, the kind of eat your peas arguments, this is healthy, this is strong, this is the good thing to do, the prudent thing to do, this is the, you will live longer, you will have more money. but, there's a whole missing thing here, isn't it? Kind of what you were talking about. There's something that's almost, I'm a lot older now, but that was about the last set of issues I was interested in my 20s, was what was prudent and helpful and eat my peas. I wanted something bigger than that. I wanted big words like courage and daring and adventure and passion. And, I wanted all those big words. So I don't know. How do we get it's the big words that are really the most important, not eat your peas and be careful. It's more like go for the whole prize. I had a pastor friend, couples would come in for counseling, and somebody would say, well, we want it all. And he would smile and say, I wish you did. So.
And what I found, too, is that this is what people really want. They do. When you can get below all their surface stuff, that they really do want see relationship and intimate relationship being a part of what's going to get them that happiness. Okay, so I think another piece too is appealing to people's. I think we have a desire to be fulfilled, to be happy, but also to feel that we're serving other people, that we're giving something back, that we're doing something that's going to make a difference. So finding ways to communicate that and to encourage and inspire social responsibility.
I have a question regarding fatherlessness in African-American and Latin-American communities specifically, because I've spent a few summers working in the inner city of D.C., especially with African-American girls, and wondering, where are their fathers? And the same thing is happening in my extended family, which is Latin-American. A lot of my cousins are now having children out of wedlock, and I'm wondering actually where they are physically. Like, is this, I've heard that there's a huge disparity in the ratio of black men and minority men in prison. Mm-hmm. Like, is this where they all are? Like, I'm not exactly sure.
Well, that's a real problem that we have in the black community, is that there's so many more black women than there are black men, and there's so many problems that, I mean, period, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's so many problems that come along with that. And then there are even fewer marriageable black men who are in a position who are not in jail or gainfully employed or whatever. So where are they? They're dying at a much earlier age.
Yeah. And is that due to anything, like life habits or...?
High rates of, as I said, these moms are trying to protect their kids from, being in these neighborhoods and being in an environment where they're much more likely to be victims of crime and be pulled into being perpetrators of crime. So that's where we're losing them a lot. They're dying at an earlier age. They're being incarcerated. They're overusing drugs and alcohol and putting themselves in positions. And I don't want to make this sound like I'm blaming mm-hmm. black men either, because there's some historical reasons for that. And there's some current day reasons for that, except, I always believe that, bottom line, people have to take responsibility for their own destiny. Okay. So, part of this is really getting the black community engaged in this, because that's, really looking at this whole issue and turning and looking at all the things that we can do to turn it around, and locking arms with, and the same thing that's happening in the Latina community, but it isn't quite as bad in the Latina community as it is in the African American community, and locking arms with others who are experiencing the same things, but to a lesser degree.
I think too, there's a more somewhat more generalized the word crisis is so overworked, but I'm just going to say among the 60% of American males who do not graduate from a four-year college, who, it's a majority. And among that majority of males, across racial, yes, there are racial differences, but the similarities are becoming more and more. There's something really, really not right with young men. Particularly those who are not going on to graduate from four-year colleges. There is something deeply, deeply amiss that runs bone deep. And I've thought a little bit about it. Linda has thought about it, and I'm sure you all have too. But it is we spent a whole generation saying, I think properly so, that we wanted to focus especially on empowering girls to have a greater sense of confidence in and strength in their own potential as to realize themselves fully as human beings. My friend Barbara Whitehead calls it the Girl Project. It's a 40-year Girl Project. And it's had a good number of successes, but we're losing an entire generation of young men.
And just to make a quick plug, I know that Dr. Wilcox just published, he's not here right now, see, he just published a journal or article called Middle America, When Marriage Disappears, which describes, I think, is that to which you were referring? It describes the plight of marriage within the population of people in the United States who have not attained this four-year degree but are slowly looking more and more like the I don't know what the how to refer to those people who have not even graduated from high school, but that lower class of the poor. And that can be available, actually. We can see about that as well. That
one other point I wanted to make is that the research shows that in any society where there's significantly more women than there are men, the men are less likely to commit, and they're more likely to be unfaithful when they do. This is something to hold on to. So it's not just in the Black community, but in any society where this occurs.
And I think we have time for one last question before our break, if anyone wants that opportunity.
So there have been many attempts in the past years in both the state and national legislatures to attempt to advocate the two-parent household through legislation. And I was wondering if you think these attempts to, these top-down approaches to changing culture have been successful, or do you think the negative backlash, that the negative attention, that the national attention brings about is undermining its own efforts?
Which do you have in mind? What are you thinking of when you say there have been many attempts?
Votes as to whether same-sex marriages should be allowed or whether there should be a national amendment to limit marriage to only opposite-sex couples.
I don't think it's had any positive effect at all. I was an expert witness in the Prop 8 trial in California on the part of the traditional definition of marriage, and so I'm against same-sex marriage. But whether you're for it or against it, if the larger question is, the largest question is not about same-sex marriage. It's not about, to me, the issue is, do we want to see marriage as a significant social institution? Is marriage something that is bigger than just my private ordering of my love relationship? In other words, if marriage is just two people are in love and that's what marriage is, if that's what it is, then first of all, I'm not that interested in it. I don't think of it as marriage, and I don't really, you know, we've lost. But if marriage is actually a social institution that orients us to certain kind of vocation, a way of living, if it's something, if we don't say what marriage is, but marriage says what we are, you know, if marriage is bigger than the couple and helps to orient the couple through rules and norms and expectations that are widely shared, if that's what marriage is, then it can work. If it's this other thing that's just a name we give to private ordering, what lawyers call private ordering, then, you know, to me, that's the issue. And what is happening now is that we are shifting rapidly toward just marriage as the name we give to private love relationships of all kinds. And the whole same-sex marriage is just one of many manifestations of that trend. I wouldn't even list gay marriage as among the top five of terms of influences for the deinstitutionalization of marriage. It's just one of a number of things going on. And so to me, the challenge would be, so that's the reason I don't think those laws have done much one way or the other is, first of all, it's become so politicized. And I mean, these men we're talking about, do you think they're sitting around being influenced by what does or doesn't happen about DOMA? It has no relationship. So to me, the challenge is to think anew as leaders about how we're going to speak and act freshly about the institution of marriage. I think, and this I'm going to maybe say something that some of you would disagree with, maybe many of you, but I think, to me, the gay marriage debate is over. It's just over. I mean, so I think, I mean, it's just over. And so it's over and we've lost. It's just going to, it's a mopping up operation now. It's just over. Completely, I mean completely, totally over. And therefore, to me, the challenge is how do we in a post-gay marriage debate world think about how we say something good and true and strong about marriage as something larger than the individual love relationship of the couple. And that is a huge challenge. And I just encourage any of you who are, you know, interested in this subject, whether it be intellectually or in terms of your vocation or professional life, this is a huge challenge. And we just so need leadership. We need creativity. We need both passion and precision brought to this subject. Thank you.
Thank you both so very much for talking with us today. If we could just give them another round of applause. That was fantastic. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we're going to have a 15-minute